This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal, by Ken Bensinger. Read by Jonathan Todd Ross. Chapter 1. Berryman. Shortly after 10 on the morning of August 16, 2011, Steve Berryman, a 47-year-old special agent for the Internal Revenue Service, was in his cubicle on the third floor of a huge federal office building known as the Ziggurat in Laguna Niguel, California, when his mobile phone vibrated. There was a new Google Alert email in his inbox. Berryman, 6 feet tall and slender, with brown eyes so dark they looked almost black, thick eyebrows, pale skin, and a neatly trimmed white mustache that matched his slicked back hair, had set up a number of such alerts. His choice of keywords betrayed a sensibility that, after 25 years at the IRS, had become highly refined when it came to financial crimes. Berryman had alerts for money laundering, corruption, Bank Secrecy Act, and Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, among many others. The messages arrived in batches throughout the day, delivering dozens of news articles from around the world about various cases of financial misbehavior that Berryman would quickly scan before returning to whatever case he happened to be working. But this particular notification stopped him in his tracks. The alert was under the search term bribery and contained a link to an article by the Reuters News Service. The headline was FBI Examines U.S. Soccer Boss's Financial Records. The story described a set of documents, allegedly being scrutinized by the FBI, that outlined more than $500,000 in suspicious payments received over a 15-year period by an American soccer official named Chuck Blazer. Blazer was a high-ranking official of FIFA, the governing body of world soccer. Berryman thought he might have heard his name somewhere, but he didn't recognize the photo of a scowling, tousle-haired man with bushy eyebrows and an unruly gray beard. An intoxicating surge of excitement swept over him as he reread the article several times, taking special note of the fact that Blazer had several offshore bank accounts, including one in the Cayman Islands. He forwarded the article to his supervisor, Amy Skabillion, then dashed into her office to make sure she'd read it. "This could be huge," he said. Berryman loved soccer ever since he was a kid. He grew up in England because his father was in the Air Force, and spent most of his first 11 years living outside military bases there, playing soccer most afternoons. When his family moved back to the States, settling in Southern California's hot, dusty inland empire, he couldn't find anyone to play with, so he transferred his soccer skills to the gridiron, becoming a star place kicker. His strong left foot earned him an athletic scholarship to Eastern Illinois University. Berryman could launch the ball 65 yards through the uprights about three-quarters of the time, but was not good enough to cut it in the professional ranks. Berryman loathed the Midwest's bitter winters. As soon as he realized that his future wasn't going to be in the NFL, he abandoned his scholarship, transferred to Cal State San Bernardino, completed his degree in accounting, and signed up to become an IRS agent. His first case was against the owner of a luxury hair salon who hadn't reported all of his income. Berryman spent his early years at the IRS investigating petty tax evaders and crooked accountants. But he was drawn to bigger, more complicated types of financial crime. He soon moved into narcotics, teaming up with other agencies on long-involved international investigations. Berryman's big revelation, working those cases, was that drugs, guns, and violence were only half the story. A full accounting of the crimes could only be told once all the money had been traced. While DEA agents dreamed up dramatic stings aimed at turning up droves of drugs, Berryman spent his time meticulously chasing the dealer's money around the world, adding additional charges, and often defendants, to the indictments. People were fallible, he realized, They played games, forgot facts, succumbed to temptation, exaggerated, and contradicted themselves. Documents never lied. After having kids, Berryman and his wife bought a house close to the ocean. He transferred to the Laguna Niguel office of the IRS, deep in Orange County, where he began working on public corruption cases, including a massive investigation that landed the county's well-known sheriff, Mike Corona, in prison. He traveled to other field offices, teaching agents about the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, spearheaded a public and foreign corrupt officials project in the IRS's main Los Angeles field office, and volunteered as a witness for federal prosecutors who needed experts on money laundering on the stand. "I'm an accountant with a gun," Berryman liked to say. "What could be more fun?" Berryman was not motivated, as some cops are, by a sense of moral indignity. Indeed, he often found himself admiring the men and women he pursued, wondering if, in other circumstances, they could have been friends. What made him tick, instead, was the thrill of the hunt. He wasn't a lawyer, but he gained a reputation as a prosecutor's agent, whose relentless focus on the mechanics of cases was matched only by his passionate attention to detail. Some higher-ups in the agency privately considered Berryman one of the best IRS agents in the entire country. Ambitious and willing to travel and work as many hours as it took to make a case stick. When he wasn't working, however, he was more likely than not thinking about soccer, which he called football, the word most of the planet uses for the game. Berryman would wake up early on weekends, sometimes before 5 a.m. to watch his favorite team, Liverpool, play English Premier League matches on cable. In 2006, he and two friends traveled to the World Cup in Germany and attended all three games played by the U.S. national team, as well as a match between Brazil and Ghana. He played in an adult soccer league, coached his kids' teams, and frequently attended MLS matches. And, like a lot of soccer fans, he'd become increasingly dismayed by constant rumors of corruption and mismanagement at the sport's highest levels. For years, Berryman had been hearing about greedy soccer officials stealing from the game, depriving teams, players, and especially fans, of money that could improve and better develop the sport. But the problem had always seemed so distant. The reports were certainly troubling to someone who cared about soccer, but these things were happening in faraway places like Switzerland, Italy, or Africa. And at any rate, certainly not in America, where soccer was still a second-rate sport, too minor for big-time corruption. Soccer might be dirty, but Berryman had never thought of the sport's problems as potentially criminal. The Reuters article changed that. Blazer was an American, living in New York. That meant potential jurisdiction, the chance to apply one of Berryman's great passions, investigating financial crimes, to his other, the world's most popular sport. If this homegrown soccer official had been involved in anything criminal, then Berryman believed he'd been born to figure out what that might be. Taxes are so fundamental to the experience of being an American that they are seen as almost sacred, dull, number-laden documents that act as Rosetta Stones to the secret financial lives of every person. The United States is one of only two countries in the world, the other being tiny, war-torn Eritrea, that requires citizens to file even when living abroad. And every year, the Internal Revenue Service processes more than 150 million individual income tax returns. There is, in fact, a special section of federal law dedicated to enshrining the private status of filings, prohibiting almost everyone, under pain of punishment, from viewing or disclosing income tax returns. That restriction includes law enforcement, up to and including the FBI itself, whose agents must jump through a series of legal hoops before they can so much as glance at a tax return. There is one group entrusted by the government to review tax returns, a caste whose unique powers have perversely earned them society's fear and disgust. Employees of the IRS. As an IRS agent, Steve Berryman had the unique power to look at anyone's taxes, provided he had good cause to believe a crime might have been committed. Thanks to the Reuters piece, he could move forward. Standing in his supervisor's office on that August Tuesday, he asked permission to pull Chuck Blazer's tax returns. Within minutes, he got his first glimpse of that crucial information. Berryman was expecting some obvious omissions or telltale signs of hidden income. The result was far better than hoped. No record found. His eyes went wide. The system was telling him that Chuck Blazer hadn't filed his taxes in at least 17 years. It can be a misdemeanor to fail to file. But if Blazer had received any income anywhere, and intentionally hid it, that could elevate the omission to a felony. And if he had foreign bank accounts that he didn't report to the government, that was a felony as well. Chuck Blazer, the only American on the executive committee of FIFA, the Fédération Internationale de Football Association, the supreme body overseeing all of global soccer, looked awfully like a tax criminal. Heart pounding, Berryman dashed back into Skibillion's office. He explained who Blazer was, what FIFA did, and how this slam-dunk tax case he'd unearthed could be a foot in the door to something far bigger. "Can I get involved?" he pleaded. Berryman wasn't one to buck authority. But for the most part, his superiors trusted his ability to select cases that were worth his time, and they stayed out of the way. Skibillion had no problem with him looking into this, but what about the FBI? The article suggested it was already an open case. If he wanted to pursue it, he'd need to clear it with the Bureau first. Berryman had no way of checking the FBI's computer systems to see if there was indeed an open case involving Blazer. So he called an FBI agent he worked with in Santa Ana and asked her to check for him. The agent called back soon thereafter. "Yes," she said. "There's an agent on it in New York. There are dozens of federal law enforcement agencies in the United States, each with their own responsibilities and powers, down to the gun-toting agents of the National Zoological Park Police and the Inspector General of the Small Business Administration. But the largest, best-funded, and most powerful of all is the Federal Bureau of Investigations. It has tens of thousands of agents, vast resources, and offices around the world. It is the star of America's legal show, basking in the attention lavished by journalists, Hollywood, and particularly, members of Congress with budget authority. Although it's common for multiple law enforcement authorities to team up on cases, investigators from other agencies quickly learned to tiptoe when dealing with the FBI. It had an uncanny knack for always coming out on top. Berryman asked his friend at the Bureau if she'd reach out to the agent in New York to see if he would consider discussing the case. "You bet," she said. She'd get back to him when she heard something. As he anxiously waited, Berryman learned everything he could about Blazer, FIFA, and international soccer. He stayed up late researching Jack Warner, a soccer official from Trinidad and Tobago who had cut $512,750 in checks to Blazer that were now under scrutiny, according to the Reuters article, and the Confederation of North, Central America, and Caribbean Association Football, which the two men had run together for more than two decades. He also read about a fabulously wealthy Qatari named Mohammed bin Hammam, who had helped the tiny Middle Eastern nation win the right to host the World Cup in 2022. He soon began to imagine a possible case, the ways it could be investigated and prosecuted, and the reach it could have. With each passing day, Berryman's enthusiasm grew until he felt more excited about this lead than any in his career. He desperately wanted in. He had no idea where the FBI's investigation had gone, but was certain its agents couldn't look at Blazer's tax returns without a court order. Berryman half hoped that they were stuck. They needed an IRS agent on the case. That was the way to muscle his way into the case, he thought, and Blazer could be just the beginning. After nearly a week, the FBI agent in Santa Ana called again. "The case agent's name is Jared Randall," she said, passing along his contact information. "He's open to it." Berryman had been prescient. Investigating Chuck Blazer's tax problem was like pulling someone over for a bum taillight, only to discover a trunk stuffed with dead bodies. Over the next 4 years, Berryman would work in secret with the FBI and federal prosecutors in Brooklyn to build one of the largest and most ambitious investigations of international corruption and money laundering in American history. After almost a year, the FBI investigation was indeed stuck, mired in the challenges of taking on an institution as vast, complex, and powerful as FIFA. But thanks in great part to Berryman, the tiny case was about to explode, with the U.S. government confronting the fundamental business underpinning the world's most popular game. Dozens of people from more than 15 different countries would eventually be charged with violating the United States' stiff racketeering, money laundering, fraud, and tax laws, exposed for their part in what prosecutors described as a decades-long, highly orchestrated criminal conspiracy calculated to twist the beloved sport to their selfish designs. Many of those caught up in the investigation would throw themselves at the mercy of the Department of Justice, forfeiting hundreds of millions of dollars and quietly agreeing to cooperate. This allowed prosecutors to secretly cast the net ever wider, as the sports officials betrayed their friends and colleagues. The case finally became public, with the dramatic arrest of 7 soccer officials in an early morning raid in Switzerland in May 2015, shaking the foundations of the sport. Soon, nearly every significant official at FIFA was ousted, including its genial yet ruthless president, the Swiss Sepp Blatter. Prosecutors in countries around the world would be inspired to open their own separate criminal investigations, helping further reveal the ugly inner workings of the sport known as the beautiful game. After decades of unchecked impunity in the face of scandals, the global soccer cartel was finally brought to its knees by one of the few countries in the entire world that didn't seem to care much about the sport at all. That irony wasn't lost on the game's hundreds of millions of fans around the globe, who found themselves in the unfamiliar position of rooting for the United States to actually stick its nose in other countries' business. Uncle Sam, implausibly, had become soccer's biggest superstar. When the clandestine case finally became public, critics accused the prosecution, led by a cerebral Harvard Law graduate named Evan Norris, of arrogance and overreach, arguing that America shouldn't try to police the entire planet or impose its laws on foreign countries. Others claimed the case represented its own kind of conspiracy, a plot by the world's wealthiest and most powerful nation to bring down a foreign sport it detested and feared. Perhaps the most popular theory was that the case was high-level retribution for passing over the U.S.'s bid to host the World Cup in 2022. Prosecutors anticipated such concerns and went to great lengths to charge only crimes that allegedly took place, at least in part, on American soil or with the use of the American financial system. Awake to the emotional and political power of soccer in the rest of the world, the feds went to considerable lengths to protect the sensitivities of other nations and drive home the point that they weren't indicting the sport, only the men who had sullied its reputation. Indeed, they took pains to argue that soccer was itself the victim of the crimes being charged, and had a right to eventually recover the money that had been stolen from it. As for the notion that some insidious, vindictive, or downright xenophobic agenda was driving the case, the truth is the FIFA probe commenced months before the voting members of FIFA's powerful executive committee chose Qatar over the U.S. to host the sport's most important tournament. America's case against soccer corruption didn't start at the top, some dictum from on high. It was the product of careful, patient police work by dedicated investigators, something that began small and grew into a far vaster endeavor than anyone involved could have imagined. And it is still very much ongoing. The saga of corruption within FIFA and worldwide soccer as a whole is immeasurably complicated, far too sprawling to capture or make sense of in any comprehensive fashion in this recording. It encompasses decades of deceit, bribery, self-dealing, and impunity, all taking place as soccer expanded geometrically to become the planet's great sporting juggernaut, a multi-billion dollar pastime driven by the ardent passions of its devoted fans. This book traces the broadest outlines of a single criminal case, notable for its numbing complexity and scope, one that pushed the boundaries of what anyone, especially disillusioned fans of the world's game, ever thought possible. It is also the tale of some of the people, brilliant and corruptible, dedicated and careless, humble and arrogant, loyal and treacherous, who made this the world's greatest sports scandal. Chapter 2. Tickling the Wire. Unimaginably far removed from its humble 19th century roots as a simple pastime for the working classes, amid the grind of the Industrial Revolution, soccer has become, in many countries, as powerful a social and cultural institution as government or the church. Fueled by the passions of hundreds of millions of devoted fans around the globe, soccer also has matured into a churning economic dynamo, pumping out vast sums of money that line the pockets of the elite who organize the sport, broadcast its matches, and plaster their corporate logos around its stadiums and across the chests of the gifted young athletes who chase after the ball. Played in every nation on earth, endless combinations of amateur and professional soccer matches, tournaments, and championships run almost continuously throughout the year. But the single event around which all global soccer is organized, the anchor to the sport's calendar and its throbbing emotional heart, is the World Cup. Created by a more modest FIFA in a more modest time, the quadrennial tournament has over the decades come to represent the apogee of the power and influence of sport, a uniquely modern, transnational, mass public spectacle for a televised era, blending rampant consumerism, corporate interests, political ambition, and unchecked financial opportunism. The month-long event, pitting the top national soccer teams against one another in an orgy of patriotic fervor, is the greatest sporting event mankind has ever conceived. On June 9, 2010, 3 days before the kickoff of the World Cup in South Africa, envoys from Russia and England stood outside a meeting room in Johannesburg's Sandton Convention Center, nervously waiting to make their pitch to host the 2018 tournament. Their audience, elected representatives of the Confederation of North, Central America, and Caribbean Association Football, or CONCACAF, FIFA's 207 member associations, each governing soccer in their countries, were split between six confederations, which oversaw the sport on a regional basis. CONCACAF, with 35 member associations under its umbrella, was one of them, and it in turn reported up to FIFA. Its territory stretched from Panama in the south to Canada in the north, and included the United States, as well as all of the Caribbean and the sparsely populated South American countries Suriname and Guyana. With the possible exception of Mexico, the Confederation's members were not considered particularly formidable on the soccer pitch. But in the cutthroat field of international soccer politics, CONCACAF was a powerhouse. That influence was largely due to Jack Warner, its Trinidadian president. Wiry, with glasses over a deeply lined face, he made a point of reminding people that he was a black man who had risen from abject poverty. He was also a born politician, able to whip all of his confederation's member nations into a reliably unified voting bloc at FIFA's annual congresses. That unrivaled discipline gave CONCACAF an outsized influence compared to other, larger soccer confederations, which constantly struggled with internal strife and factionalism, splitting their votes sometimes several ways. It also made Warner, 67 years old at the time, one of the most powerful and feared men in all of soccer. Over the previous 3 decades, he had deployed guile, persistence, and ruthless discipline to bring the Caribbean, and with it the whole Confederation, to heal. His position was rarely, if ever, challenged. In exchange for the generous disbursement of money that spilled down through him from the highest reaches of the sport, he expected his member associations to vote exactly as he instructed. Born into grinding poverty in the Trinidadian countryside, the slender, combative Warner had risen to become the third-ranking vice president of FIFA and the longest-serving member of its executive committee, or EXCO, the 24-man body tasked with making FIFA's most important decisions, including determining where World Cups are held. Warner was also powerful in other circles. Less than 2 weeks before flying to South Africa to attend the tournament, he had been sworn in as Trinidad and Tobago's Minister of Works and Transport. Warner's power within FIFA was enhanced by his closest ally, Chuck Blazer, a morbidly obese Jewish New Yorker with a head for business and a shaggy white beard that made him a dead ringer for Santa Claus. A compulsive gambler guided by seemingly insatiable appetites and inextinguishable opportunism, Blazer had been the brains behind Warner's political fortunes, and, in great measure, the spectacular growth of soccer in North America. He'd been CONCACAF's general secretary, a second-in-command charged with manning day-to-day operations, since 1990, and had sat with Warner on FIFA's EXCO since 1997. A third CONCACAF official, Guatemalan Rafael Salguero, also sat on the FIFA's 24-member governing committee, and he was expected to cast his votes in lockstep with his Confederation colleagues. Anyone bidding for the tournament knew that courting Warner and Blazer was critical, and that both men were willing to put a price on anything, including soccer's highest prize. The EXCO vote on where to host both the 2018 and 2022 World Cups was to be held in Zurich on December 2nd. And with just under 6 months to go, the CONCACAF meeting in Johannesburg was viewed as a critical sales opportunity. England hadn't hosted the tournament since 1966. Its soccer-crazed population was desperate to do so again. London was slated to host the 2012 Olympics, and the British government calculated that a World Cup would boost its economy by nearly $5 billion. It would also have incalculable social and psychological value for the country, which, as its fans were quick to note, invented the sport in the first place. England was up against a number of competitors. Belgium and the Netherlands had joined together to make up one rival bid, and Spain and Portugal another. A host of other countries were battling separately for the rights to the 2022 World Cup, among them the United States, Australia, and Qatar. But England's most formidable adversary for 2018 was, without a doubt, Russia. Russia had been awarded the 2014 Winter Olympics just 18 months earlier, and had been riding nearly a decade of spectacular economic growth, thanks largely to record prices for oil and other natural resources. The country, and particularly its leader, Vladimir Putin, had been eager to take advantage of that boom to reassert its long-relinquished role as a world power, winning the right to host the World Cup, watched by hundreds of millions around the world, would undoubtedly be an effective way to help plant that idea, projecting strength and stability. Most critically, it would boost Putin's image among the Russian people. Losing the vote, for Putin, was unthinkable. In a nod to fairness and perhaps the short attention span of many of its delegates, CONCACAF had allotted 12 minutes for each bid team to make its best case. Russia's delegation, led by Alexei Sorokin, the Russian Football Union's general secretary, presented first. It did not go well. For starters, Russia's national soccer team had failed to qualify for the 2010 World Cup, thanks to a humiliating loss the prior November to lowly Slovenia, a country with a total population only slightly larger than the Siberian city of Novosibirsk. And Blazer, viewed as a likely vote for England, was not even in the room. A diabetic with nagging respiratory problems, he had decided to avoid Johannesburg because the city's high altitude affected his health. Russia's presentation, meanwhile, was embarrassingly marred by a glitchy PowerPoint deck that failed three times as Sorokin spoke. Sorokin, handsome and polished with excellent American-accented English and a toothy smile, exuded confidence. But his pitch, spotlighting drab, distant cities like Yekaterinburg, lacked any sparkle or charm. The audience of mostly Caribbean and Central American officials seemed unmoved, if not downright bored. By comparison, England's bid team turned in a dazzling performance. David Dean, a debonair, impeccably tailored former vice chairman of London's Arsenal Soccer Club, looked and sounded like the kindly rich uncle everyone wished they had, with regal features and the poshest of accents. He warmed up the room with a joke. "The last time I did it in 12 minutes, I was 18 years old. That brought forth peals of laughter. Then he queued up a video starring superstar midfielder David Beckham. It highlighted the fact that England already possessed enough state-of-the-art stadiums, not to mention airports, hotels, and highways, to host the World Cup more or less immediately. No construction needed. The English press, in a fit of uncharacteristic optimism, hailed the presentation as a sign that England's chances looked good, and that technical prowess, existing infrastructure, and general competency, merit, would win the day. The Russians, however, were playing a different game. South Africa is not a wealthy country. More than half its population, some 30 million people, lives below the poverty line, and unemployment perennially hovers around 25%. Soccer is its most popular sport, followed avidly by the nation's black African population, which makes up an overwhelming majority of the citizenry. To prepare for the 2010 World Cup, which it had desperately sought to host for years, South Africa spent more than $3 billion in public money, largely on stadiums and transportation infrastructure. Original projections had been as little as a tenth of that amount, but the stringent requirements imposed by FIFA, motivated almost entirely by a desire to maximize revenue during the short-lived tournament, drove the figure up massively. Rather than improving or expanding many existing sports venues, South Africa was compelled by FIFA to construct half of the World Cup stadiums from the ground up, mostly in affluent, tourist-friendly white neighborhoods where soccer is far less popular than rugby and cricket. So many of the country's top professional clubs continued to play in decaying old arenas, while some stadiums built for the World Cup would not regularly be used for soccer after the tournament concluded. A new high-speed rail system that opened just prior to the tournament ended up serving largely as a shuttle between wealthy areas and the stadiums, with no service anywhere close to the vast shanty towns where many of the nation's poor live. The message? Poor people were apparently not welcome. FIFA's profound influence over the sovereign nation was hardly limited to infrastructure boondoggles. In order to host the tournament, South Africa had to agree to comply with scores of strict requirements imposed by the Swiss nonprofit, including amending or suspending many of its tax and immigration laws, sometimes at great financial cost to the country. South Africa was even made to employ its police and judicial system to rigorously enforce FIFA's trademarks and copyrights in order to protect profits from sales of merchandise that the country had, ironically, promised not to tax. In exchange for all the generosity, FIFA had pledged to pour huge sums into development of the sport in South Africa. But in the end, it paid for little more than a handful of artificial turf soccer fields it had promised, along with a number of buses and vans it donated to South Africa's Soccer Federation for clubs to transport players to matches. By some estimates, FIFA donated less than 0.1% of its profits from the tournament. So it was nearly everywhere FIFA held sway. While the ruling football body reported ever-growing profits, those who most passionately follow the sport saw little benefit or were shut out of it altogether. South Africa has never been a formidable soccer power. its national team has never progressed beyond the group stage at the World Cup. But even in countries such as Brazil and Argentina, the spiritual meccas of the sport and homelands to legendary talents including Pelé, Diego Maradona, and Lionel Messi, glaring examples of the sport's inequities abounded. Professional clubs in those nations played in dank and outdated stadiums, often lacking even the most rudimentary bathroom facilities for fans. Many children in South America learned the sport without the benefit of proper pitches, coaching, balls, or even shoes. Young girls were given little, if any, opportunity to play at all. The men who controlled soccer in each country, meanwhile, enjoyed a life of rare privilege, jetting from tournament to tournament to be lavished with the finest luxuries, praised, revered, and wooed as overlords of the people's sport. These officials of their national associations, FIFA's six regional confederations, and FIFA itself, lived in a rarefied bubble, one that often seemed strangely removed from the sport itself, but was never more frothy than when another World Cup, or in this case two of them, was up for grabs. 2 days after the CONCACAF meeting in Johannesburg, FIFA held what it dubbed a bidding expo, a sort of commercial trade show for the World Cup itself. The event provided all nine countries competing for the right to host the 2018 and 2022 tournaments the chance to meet delegates from around the world. In particular, it was an opportunity to mingle with nearly every executive committee member. Several hours beforehand, Russian billionaire Roman Abramovich walked into Johannesburg's Gallagher Convention Center. Abramovich, who owned England's Chelsea Football Club, had arrived that day on his private jet, accompanied by Igor Shuvalov, Russia's first deputy prime minister. A high school dropout and former auto mechanic and commodities trader, whose fortune was made thanks to his staunch support of Boris Yeltsin, Abramovich came to control Sibneft, one of Russia's largest oil producers. Subsequently, he supported Vladimir Putin as a candidate to succeed Yeltsin, and was richly rewarded for his loyalty. A devoted soccer fan, Abramovich bought Chelsea, one of England's most storied clubs, in 2003, and moved to London 5 years later after selling off much of his Russian holdings. Unlike many oligarchs who left Russia, Abramovich maintained a close relationship with Putin. A frequent Kremlin visitor, he regarded the former KGB officer as a kind of father figure, speaking to him in the most formal, reverent tones. Among those who followed such things, it was well known that Putin occasionally called on Abramovich for special favors. As a rule, billionaires hate to wait for anything. But once the bidding expo began, the normally shy and retiring Abramovich, wearing a tailored charcoal suit rather than his usual jeans, made an unusually enthusiastic show of good cheer. A smile plastered over his unshaven jaw. He joined a contingent of countrymen, including Andrei Arshavin, a star forward for English club Arsenal, in the Russian booth, greeting soccer officials from around the world and mugging for photographs with David Beckham. And finally, when the expo was drawing to a close, Abramovich walked out of the hall alongside Sepp Blatter, the Swiss president of FIFA. With so much attention cast in Beckham's direction, scarcely anyone even noticed them quietly departing together. Earlier in the day, Blatter had bragged to FIFA's entire membership about the organization's record profits in the 4 years leading up to 2010. He boasted of FIFA having $1 billion in the bank, and grandly pledged to distribute $250,000 to each member association as a bonus, plus $2.5 million to each confederation. It was the kind of naked patronage that had earned him the adoration of many of FIFA's 207 members, a larger assembly than that of the United Nations. As he announced in a press conference after the Congress concluded, Blatter was planning to run for a fourth consecutive term as FIFA president. "We shall work for the next generation," he said, intentionally paraphrasing Winston Churchill. After a dozen years in office and 17 years before that as general secretary, Blatter had grown acutely aware of the cost of maintaining power in an organization as wealthy, diverse, and cutthroat as FIFA. More than anyone, he had mastered the darker arts of administering the world's most popular sport, and had a hand in many of its most Machiavellian deals and accommodations over the years. Engrossed in hushed conversation, the unusually jocular Russian billionaire and the balding diminutive FIFA president rode an escalator together up to the convention center's second floor. Then the two powerful men slipped into a private meeting room and quietly closed the door. While most of the world was caught up in the drama and passion of the South African World Cup, retired spy Christopher Steele, sitting in a sparsely decorated office suite on the second floor of a 19th-century building in the posh Belgravia district of West London, found himself occupied by other matters. A Cambridge graduate, Steele had spent several years undercover in Moscow in the early 1990s, and in the mid-2000s held a senior post on the Russian desk at M16 headquarters in London. In that job, he played a key role in determining that the mysterious death of former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko, who was killed by ingesting radioactive polonium in 2006, was likely a hit approved by Vladimir Putin. Steele, with a shock of graying brown hair, remarkably even features and clear blue eyes, was urbane, well-mannered, and self-assured. Serious, precise, and careful, he was known among those who cared about such things as someone who could procure the most sensitive information concerning Russia's clandestine activities. Since the prior year, Steele had also become a capitalist, opening a research firm called Orbis Business Intelligence and looking for opportunities to convert his deep knowledge of Russian affairs, based in great part on his web of well-placed contacts still in the country, into profits. He did some government work, providing information for intelligence and police agencies, but Steele's bread and butter was private companies and law firms that wanted to dig up dirt on business rivals in Russia or gather gossip about the commercial activities of the country's fantastically wealthy oligarchs. Most recently, Steele had been retained by a group of individuals and companies supporting England's World Cup bid, and willing to pay to gain an edge in the competition to host soccer's greatest prize. For those running England 2018, as the bid was officially called, it was evident that winning the right to host was going to depend on more than just the quality of each country's stadiums, airports, and soccer. Steele was brought in to gather intelligence on the competing bids and help England 2018, he would later note. Better understand what they were up against, and what they were up against was a completely alien way of doing business. Vladimir Putin was a passionate ice hockey fan with no interest in soccer, but he nonetheless recognized the propaganda value of hosting such an event. A Russia World Cup would build off the 2014 Sochi Olympics, creating a nationalistic furor that could help the strongman maintain power for years to come. At first, he had entrusted his sports minister and trusted advisor, Vitaly Mutko, who was also a member of the FIFA Exco, to run the bid. But it had become clear that Mother Russia was not a front-runner. She was losing the public relations battle. The World Cup could easily slip out of her grasp. Then, in the spring of 2010, not long after sources began saying that Putin had suddenly taken a strong personal interest in the bid, Steele began hearing a string of curious and troubling rumors. In April, Deputy Prime Minister Igor Sechin went to Qatar to discuss a massive natural gas extraction project at almost the exact same time that Russia's World Cup bid team also traveled to Doha. One of Steele's best sources said the timing was no coincidence, and that on top of massive gas deals, the emissaries were colluding to swap World Cup votes. Russia, the theory went, would pledge its Exco members' vote for 2022 to Qatar, and Qatar would promise that, in exchange, its Exco member would pick Russia for 2018. Other sources, meanwhile, began whispering that Russian bid officials had taken valuable paintings from the Hermitage Museum and offered them to Exco members in exchange for votes. Then in mid-May, Lord David Treisman, the chairman of England's 147-year-old football association, was caught on tape discussing what he described as a Russian plot to bribe referees at the 2010 World Cup to favor Spain in exchange for a promise from the Iberian country to drop its bid for 2018. Treisman had been secretly recorded by a young woman he was with in a London cafe. Speaking unguardedly, he commented that such a plan wouldn't hurt Russia, since it wasn't even competing in the 2010 tournament. My assumption is that the Latin Americans, although they've not said so, will vote for Spain, Treisman confided to his companion, and if Spain drop out, because Spain are looking for help from the Russians to help bribe the referees in the World Cup, their votes may then switch to Russia. Incredulous, his date asked, "Would Russia help them with that?" "Oh," Treisman replied, "I think Russia will cut deals." Unhappily for Treisman, and for the panicked English bid, his cafe companion gave the tape recording to a London tabloid. Its publication generated a burst of outrage in Britain as well as sharp protestations of innocence from both the Russians and the Spanish. Treisman, who had headed the FA since early 2008, resigned within days, citing concern his comments could hurt the English bid. For Steele, Treisman's loose lips weren't the issue. As far as the ex-spy was concerned, the headline, bolstered by the fresh reports of Abramovich's private meeting with Blatter in Johannesburg, was clearly Russia. He reported his findings to his client, and members of the bid team were predictably alarmed. England was doomed. Steele felt certain. It was never going to beat out a country like Russia, which was clearly prepared to do anything to avoid a humiliating defeat on the world stage. But the former spy then had a second thought. The information he had been developing on Russia and FIFA was highly specific, but also unique and potentially valuable. Perhaps extremely so. It would be a shame to see it go to waste. And it just so happened that Steele could think of another potential client for that info. An American in law enforcement whom he'd only recently met. Special Agent Mike Gaeta took command of the FBI's Eurasian Organized Crime Squad in New York at the tail end of 2009. Every squad in the New York field office is assigned a number. C1, for example, is a white-collar crime team, and C13 is one of several narcotics groups. When C24, the Eurasian Organized Crime Squad, was established in 1994, it was the first of its kind in the nation. Created to focus on the illicit activities of organized groups of Russians, Ukrainians, Chechens, Georgians, Armenians, and even ethnic Koreans hailing from eastern stretches of Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan. After the fall of the Soviet Union, crime syndicates from these regions flooded into the United States. Although they dipped their hands into old-fashioned protection rackets and narcotics, they also had a flair for complex tax, bankruptcy, insurance, and healthcare frauds, and displayed an unusual propensity for violence. C-24 flourished in the 1990s, with big busts of godfathers such as Vyacheslav Ivankov, a former wrestler who terrorized Brighton Beach with vast extortion scams. But after September 11th, things changed. FBI Director Robert Mueller shifted more than 2,000 agents into counterterrorism and counterintelligence, and C-24, like a lot of squads, took a hit. By the time Gaeta took over C-24 in late 2009, fully half of the FBI's resources were allocated to national security and counterterrorism. What FBI brass often called traditional organized crime, meanwhile, was starved of resources. Far more important, Mueller made clear, was a vaguely defined category he called transnational organized crime. Gaeta's new squad was understaffed, but he figured if he made the case that the Russian mob was in fact committing transnational organized crime, and if he could bring some cases that stretched beyond the border, C-24 could get more support. The son of an NYPD detective, Gaeta, with smooth Mediterranean skin and a muscular build, made a point of wearing expensive suits and shirts with eye-catching cufflinks. He went to law school at Fordham, and after 2 miserable years doing insurance work in a Manhattan law firm, signed on with the FBI. Gaeta had spent most of his career working Italian mafia cases, including a dozen years on the Genovese Crime Squad, a special task force focused on just one of New York's 5 ruling mafia families. The job taught Gaeta about old-school police work, about getting out of the office and talking to people, and, whenever possible, recording suspects. His favorite trick was to knock unannounced on the front door of a suspect's house and identify himself as an FBI agent, all smiles, pretending to know nothing before handing over his business card and leaving. Little did the guy know, but the Bureau had already secretly tapped the guy's phone, and tapes were rolling to capture the panicked call the suspect would invariably place soon afterward. "Boss, I just got a visit from the feds. What are we going to do?" Gaeta called that tickling the wire. Over the years, his speech grew thick with mafia jargon. At times, it sounded as if he saw everything through the same lens he used when busting people named Hot Dog Spitalia and Vincent Chin Gigante. La Cosa Nostra was Gaeta's world. It was one populated by capos, soldiers, made men, and wise guys who could do 10 years in the joint standing on their head. He didn't speak a word of Russian. Other than a brief trip to Moscow as an undergrad, he knew little about the country, and even less about its network of criminals. But Gaeta figured it couldn't be all that different than running after Genovese bosses. Criminals fascinated him, and he loved the thrill of chasing them down. So he started off by reviewing C-24's open cases. One, involving an illegal gambling ring, seemed to hold particular promise. Tips from informants and a series of wiretaps suggested that a small cadre of Russians had been running high-stakes poker games in New York and Los Angeles, as well as a sophisticated online sportsbook. The case involved a who's who of wealthy and powerful suspects, including celebrities and professional poker players, but the most intriguing figure was Alimjan Takhtakhonov. Born in Uzbekistan in a Uyghur family, Takhtakhonov's nickname was Taiwanchik. As a young man, he had been an amateur soccer player. In 2002, he was indicted by a federal grand jury for allegedly bribing a figure skating judge at the Salt Lake City Olympics to give the gold medal to a pair of Russian skaters. Taiwanchik had been arrested in Italy soon thereafter. But when prosecutors failed in their bid to extradite him to the U.S., he returned to Russia for good. Now, one of Gaeta's agents was building evidence that Taiwanchik had helped finance the gambling operation, laundering tens of millions of dollars from Russia and Ukraine through the U.S. in the process. Making a case against a man the Justice Department already considered an international fugitive, and one who allegedly had deep ties to organized crime in multiple countries? That certainly seemed to qualify as transnational. Outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg, London was the world's hub for Russians. Since the Soviet Union collapsed, the United Kingdom had been awash in cash from Russians looking to buy property abroad. London was also thick with academics, diplomats, consultants, and other experts in Russian affairs. Because of the city's role as one of the world's principal banking centers, British law enforcement kept close watch on money laundering activity, particularly by Russians. In April 2010, Gaeta traveled to London to gather leads. Given the FBI's interest in suspects within Russia's borders, he was soon directed to Christopher Steele, who was always on the lookout for new business. The Bureau, the retired spy knew, was known to be a gold-plated client. Sitting in his cozy offices during their first meeting, Steele had assured Gaeta that he could certainly look into Taiwanchik and sports corruption, and the two had pledged to stay in touch. Only 2 months had passed, but now Steele had something that felt quite a bit hotter on his hands, the intelligence he was getting on the World Cup, Russia, and FIFA in general. Never mind online sports betting and poker rooms, there was high-level bribery, money laundering, and other cross-border crimes at play, exactly what Gaeta had expressed so much interest in when they first met. So Steele reached out to the FBI agent to ask if, by any chance, he'd be visiting London again soon. There was someone he wanted him to meet. Chapter 3. Have you ever taken a bribe? In the soccer world, investigative journalist Andrew Jennings occupied a unique place. He was far from the only reporter to have ever dug into the sordid business of the beautiful game. Legions of scribes from all over Europe and South America have been picking apart the sports management at the local level since the 1970s. but few, if any, journalists could match Jennings' obsessive drive to root out corruption or his manic flair for the dramatic. Whether standing among the crowd at a press conference or chasing an Exco member down the street, Jennings always found a way to draw attention to himself as well as the men he excoriated. After years of covering corruption in the Olympics and writing several books on the subject, Jennings turned to FIFA, which had received scant, if any, critical attention from a press corps more interested in access and boosterism. Jennings, bored by the sport of soccer itself, wasted little time in making it known he would be taking a different approach. At a press conference recorded on video soon after Blatter was elected for his second term as FIFA president in 2002, Jennings, whose typical work uniform of t-shirt, photographer vest, and hiking boots contrasted sharply with the rigorously formal attire of the FIFA elite, grabbed the microphone. "Herr Blatter," the snowy-haired Jennings inquired in his high, nasally voice, "have you ever taken a bribe?" That kind of TV-friendly, in-the-face interaction, along with a long string of scandalous scoops, became a Jennings trademark, and over the years he found 1,000 creative ways to be screamed at, insulted, and sued for libel by many of the biggest names in the sport. He wrote another book, overflowing with revelations about soccer eminences, but in particular Sepp Blatter and Jack Warner, and he gloated to anyone who would listen that FIFA, tired of his antics, finally banned him from all its events. Over time, the irascible Jennings became the go-to source for leaks in the close-knit soccer community. Although he relentlessly dug up more dirt, Jennings also grew frustrated at how little, other than outrage, ever came of all his exposés. As far as he was concerned, the men controlling the sport belonged behind bars, but nobody seemed to be listening. Then in late 2009, he got a call from Christopher Steele, wondering if the two could have a little chat about soccer. Jennings agreed, on the condition that Steele come to him in Penrith, the sleepy town in the far northern reaches of England where he lived, and that he'd give him £250 for his time. Not long thereafter, Steele paid for Jennings to make a trip to Zurich, where he met with some of his soccer sources whom he had been wanting to meet with anyway, then dutifully filed a report on what they told him. The two followed up with a few phone calls, and the former spy struck Jennings as friendly and intelligent, even if the information Steele was seeking seemed rather basic. It was clear he had a client, but he would never tell Jennings who it was, and communications dropped off until the summer of 2010, when Steele called again to ask if he'd make the trip to London to meet some very important people. The train from Penrith to central London takes just under 4 hours, and during the journey, the wily reporter didn't know what to expect. But what greeted him when he walked into the second-floor Belgravia offices of Orbis Business Intelligence on a warm July day in 2010 was in fact exactly what he had been waiting so many years to see. The main room, behind an unmarked door with a quirky porthole window, was spare and quiet, with white walls and a scattering of desks staffed by young researchers. Behind a second door was the smaller office Steele shared with his business partner. Inside waited the FBI. Mike Gaeta, impeccably dressed as always, radiated experience and self-confidence, and his New York accent, straight out of a primetime police procedural, only added to the package. Another FBI agent, younger with short-cropped hair and wide eyes, looked to Jennings like he must have come to the Bureau directly from the Marine Corps. A third man introduced himself as chief of the Justice Department's Organized Crime and Racketeering Section in Washington, D.C. The men told Jennings they specialized in organized crime, particularly focusing on Russian and Ukrainian matters. They had lately become interested in FIFA, they said, and wondered if maybe he'd help them get up to speed on the topic and tell them about the ways it might be corrupt. Jennings's building excitement was now rounding the corner to flat-out giddiness. At last, he thought. Action movies aside, FBI agents spend very little time smashing down doors, conducting high-speed car chases, and getting into bloody shootouts with steely-eyed crime lords. Much of what they do involves calmly and patiently talking to people. Agents search out and recruit people who can help build cases. It might be a perpetrator or witness to a crime, someone in a position where they could attain useful information, or a person with significant knowledge on a relevant topic. The FBI's formal term for such informants is confidential human sources, and they are the lifeblood of most investigations. Agents learn that the core of their job is to build and nurture relationships with them. Sometimes over